The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Every day that we go through this process, it is more highly likely that we do not need to authorize a draw from the state's savings accounts.
State lawmakers get closer on funding hundreds of millions of dollars worth of construction projects. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the community of Koktovik considers bringing back the region's polar bear tours.
I'm excited for tour season to be back, both for the community and those who work for it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Governor Mike Dunleavy is out with a new bill offering tax breaks for a planned natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to South Central Alaska. The bill would exempt the Alaska LNG project from a variety of local property and sales taxes. They'd be replaced by a tax on the volume of gas flowing through the pipeline once it comes online. In an interview with KDLL in Kenai, Dunleavy pitched it as a restructuring of the state's tax laws in an effort to make the project pencil out.
This makes Alaska a little more competitive because our costs are higher to begin with.
Dunleavy says the project would be worth billions of dollars in state and local tax revenue. And he says he worked with mayors of the five municipalities that would host the line as he developed the proposal. But Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Grier Hopkins says they didn't approve the bill Dunleavy introduced.
This is the bill that we've been discussing, but it's not language that us as the five municipal mayors have agreed to. It was introduced, in my understanding, and I got a voicemail from the governor this morning, that this is in order to move forward and start having legislative hearings as we continue to work towards language that all five of us as municipalities can agree on, as well with the governor.
Hopkins says he wants to ensure municipalities don't lose revenue and also benefit from lower energy prices. He says he wants the project to include a spur line to Fairbanks. The private developer working with the state to advance the project, Glenn Farn, applauded the bill in a lengthy statement on Friday. It has yet to make a final decision on whether to build the pipeline. Lawmakers in Juneau set up a committee this week to hammer out a final draft of a budget bill that would fund hundreds of millions of dollars worth of construction projects across the state. The bill also includes tens of millions for disaster relief and wildfire suppression and would refill a scholarship fund lawmakers used to bridge a budget gap last year. The supplemental budget bill stalled in the House last week after minority Republicans opposed a draw from savings. That requires a three-quarters supermajority. They argued a war-driven increase in oil prices means the state will have the money to pay for the bill without a savings draw. The Democrat-heavy bipartisan House majority said that passing the bill without a savings draw in a volatile time for oil prices was risky. Anchorage Democratic Representative Andy Josephson is leading the conference committee, and he says he expects lawmakers to rework the bill so that the state only uses savings if necessary.
What might flow first is general fund dollars from an increase in oil severance taxes, and then second, failing that, CBR draw. So that's probably what you're going to see. There's nothing terribly radical about it.
It's also possible the bill could expand to include items cut from an earlier version. Josephson says that's up for negotiation. Those items are mostly state agency expenses that went above what lawmakers budgeted for last year. Fairbanks Republican Representative Will Stapp is one of two minority caucus members negotiating the bill. He says talks are just getting started, but he's still skeptical of any draw from savings.
Every day that we go through this process, it is more highly likely that we do not need to authorize a draw from the state's savings accounts, to pay these expenditures. So And if we do, I mean, we also have more time in session to revisit that.
The bill as a whole could pass and head to the governor's desk with a simple majority vote, even if the supermajority vote to spend from savings fails. Stapp says he's frustrated that hasn't happened already. Josephson says he expects the bill to go to the House and Senate floors for a final vote early next week. The North Slope community of Koktovik is known as the polar bear capital of the U.S. Hundreds of tourists used to flock to the Inupiat village of about 250 people to see bears, but about 5 years ago, the tours were halted because of opposition from residents. Alona Nyden with the Alaska Desk has more on what happened to the tours and what the community is doing to revive them.
It's polar bear ground right there.
Nathan Gordon Jr. is driving his truck on the spit right outside of Koktovik. He's mayor and leads the town's polar bear patrol program. Under his back seat, he has a shotgun, and in his console, shotgun rounds and cracker shells.
They're explosive rounds, both of them. I have those ones, then lethal rounds in the front, and then less than lethal rounds in here. So I keep them separate.
Koktovik sits on Barter Island on the Beaufort Sea coast, offshore from the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. In late summer and fall, up to 80 polar bears come on land, a trend that has been increasing as the sea ice diminishes. That brought the need for patrol and created opportunities for polar bear viewing that flourished before the pandemic.
It was booming during the fall time. Like, the whole 3 months would cover the other 9 months of money that was made at the hotel.
But in 2020, the pandemic put a pause on visitation. Then the federal government halted the tours following significant community opposition. They never reopened. Gordon says Koktovik leaders have been working to revive them.
I'm excited for tour season to be back, both for the community and those who work for it. Let's get this place back to making money, and it'll be great for everybody.
Kitil Reitan was among those who caught the polar bear tourism wave. A prominent Norwegian musher who repeatedly competed in the Iditarod, Reitan lived in Koktovik for decades and started the company Koktovik Tours in 2010.
We started in very small scale and it grew every year. And the last year, the whole season was almost fully booked. So it was very popular and clients were very happy to come and see the polar bears in Koktovik.
By 2019, he says he and his two children took several hundred tourists a season on their two boats, a rare economic opportunity in a village with limited jobs.
We were able to make a year income in about 6 weeks.
Reitan was not alone. At least five Koktovik companies offered polar bear tours, according to the city's comprehensive plan. The number of tourists soared from about 50 in 2010 to over 1,000 in 2015. But Koktovik polar bear tourism grew so quickly, residents were worried it was interfering with subsistence practices and disrupting life in the village. While many guides were local, there were also outside companies that flew tourists for a day without spending money in the community. Nora Jane Burns is a former guide who also helped found Polar Bear Patrol. She says that some tourists and guides approached bears too closely or even fed and baited them. But the main source of pushback to tours was an argument that visitors would book out seats on small flights and limit the amount of freight that was coming in.
That was the catalyst that kind of got everybody, especially when we have elders that go out for medical, and then when they try to come back, the flights would be booked.
The COVID-19 pandemic shut down the tours. And a year later, the U.S. Department of Interior issued an order to pause commercial polar bear viewing permits until the effects of the industry were more defined. Since then, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the agency that oversees boat tours, has been collaborating with the city and village of Koktovik, as well as Koktovik Inupiat Corporation. They have been working on a management plan for polar bear viewing. Gordon says that this time around, he wants the community to develop infrastructure for tourists and focus more on educating them through brochures, signs, videos, and in-person conversations.
Just putting out knowledge to those who come in would be the easiest answer to fixing tourism problems. I think we'll be way more prepared for tourism this time.
But who will run the tours? Burns is busy with her job at Koktovik Public Works Department. and Rayton sold his boats and moved to Nome. But they both hope the younger generation will take over polar bear tours, if and when they're back. With reporting from Kaktohvik, I am Alena Naidin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Petersburg's longtime basketball coach is recognized with a national award.
It's not me. It's all the guys that have played, all the hours and time that they put in, their families.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Work is underway to rebuild an important cargo dock in Anchorage, part of a larger $2.7 billion project to improve the Don Young Port of Alaska that began more than a decade ago. Efforts to tear down and rebuild the port's Cargo Terminal 1 started Monday after an official notice to proceed from Anchorage Mayor Suzanne LaFrance. It's just the latest phase of the Port of Alaska Modernization Program and represents Anchorage's largest capital project in the city's 50-year history. LaFrance says the port is crucially important to Alaskans across the state.
Well, the Don Young Port of Alaska is a critical piece of infrastructure, not just for Anchorage residents, but for most residents of the state of Alaska.
About 75% of the state's inbound cargo comes through the port, driving more than $14 billion in statewide economic activity annually, according to city and port officials. The larger modernization project aims to upgrade the entire port and address its aging and corroding terminals after engineers determined they would likely fail in the event of a large earthquake. Port Director Terry Umatum says it's important for Alaskans to know there's a team keeping the port operating every day. But he says the upgrade to the cargo terminals is long overdue.
This port and this infrastructure has not been maintained to the levels it should have been over the last 50 years, and we are now excited to fix that problem.
The work on Cargo Terminal 1 is not expected to interrupt the shipment of cargo through the port and is expected to be completed by 2029. Alaska's rural school districts recruit heavily from abroad to fill teaching positions in their classrooms. But in the fall, President Donald Trump virtually shut that labor market down with a huge increase in the fee employers must pay for the visa those international workers need. In Kodiak Island Borough's public schools, nearly one in five current teachers have a visa. Now it's recruitment season for next school year, and the district's top administrator tells KMXT's Davis Hovey international teachers are not being recruited.
Kodiak Island Borough School District Superintendent Cindy Mika says 26 of her teachers hold H-1B visas, which let highly skilled foreigners work in the United States for up to 6 years and can lead to permanent residence.
Not having the ability to hire internationally for Kodiak could mean the difference in having a teacher in front of students and not having a teacher in front of students next year.
Current teachers are not affected by Trump's new $100,000 visa fee, which is 20 times higher than the old fee. But it's too much for the district and others across the state to cover.
We actually are not currently recruiting from the Philippines for the first time since I moved here 4 years ago, because we cannot afford the $100,000 fee that is now imposed at the embassy in order to obtain our visas.
President Trump claimed in his executive order that the high fee will address employers' abuse of the system to undercut American workers. But part of the reason the school district started hiring teachers from the Philippines several years ago was because American candidates stopped applying. Mika says school districts used to find hundreds of potential teachers at in-person state job fairs.
The last job fair in the state was 2 years ago. We had the same 53 districts, and two teachers walked in the door of that job fair. Two applicants.
H-1B visa teachers fill crucial roles across the Kodiak Island Borough School District, such as the high school music orchestra teacher, special education teachers, and teaching staff in rural communities like Old Harbor, for example. Assistant Superintendent Kim Saunders says this year, for the first time, the district retained all of its rural school teachers, thanks in part to the international recruits. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski introduced a bill last week to exempt public schools across the country from paying the $100,000 fee. Saunders appreciates Murkowski's support, but even if the bill does pass quickly, she says it would not help recruiting that's happening now.
This would be a longer-term solution that Murkowski is proposing, which we're very grateful for, but you're really talking about an FY28 solution, not a 27 solution.
She said that KIBSD is looking at alternatives. In the meantime, the district has started sending out contracts to its non-tenured teachers and is trying to determine its staffing needs for next school year. Statewide, 573 educators are international teachers on various visas, according to Lisa Parody, the executive director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators. That's 8.5% of Alaska's teaching workforce. She says in some rural districts, more than half of the teachers are serving on visas. Parody told state lawmakers earlier this month that districts have been forced into an impossible choice.
Pay millions in visa fees and cut student programs, or go without teachers and leave classrooms uncovered. Neither option is acceptable for our students and children in Alaska.
There are also 11 international teachers in the Kodiak Island Borough School District who need to renew their visas this year. It's unclear how the ongoing government shutdown at the Department of Homeland Security will affect that process. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
The U.S. Interior Department held its second round of tribal consultations on subsistence hunting and fishing on federal land this week. Tribal leaders were invited to attend the meeting at the agency's Fish and Wildlife Service headquarters in Anchorage or online. The gatherings, which have been closed to the public, gave tribal and Alaska Native Corporation leaders a chance to question the Interior Department about a Safari Club International petition to reform federal subsistence management. The Alaska Federation of Natives is among dozens of organizations fighting the proposals, which call for eliminating public and private seats on the Federal Subsistence Board and limiting them to the heads of five federal agencies. AFN co-chair Gayla Hossett says tribes fear this would result in poor decision-making because federal managers are not from Alaska and rotate in and out of the state.
How is that one person coming from the lower 48 going to understand certain areas around Alaska, the landscape, the snow conditions, the water conditions? What is life like out there? What does a wildlife population look like? How hard is it to harvest moose? Harvesting moose is easy in some areas and really hard with different terrain in different parts of Alaska.
The Interior Department is taking public comment on the Safari Club proposals until March 30th. The Safari Club says its proposals would streamline wildlife management and give more authority to the state. Opponents say they threaten the rural subsistence priority guaranteed under federal law. On Wednesday, Bethel musher Pete Kaiser and his sled dog team took ninth place in the Iditarod. Facing challenges along the 1,000-mile race trail from Willow to Nome, Kaiser crossed the finish line with half the dogs he'd started with. But as KYUK's Samantha Watson reports, there was a lot to be excited about, especially in Kaiser's last few minutes on the race trail.
Ladies and gentlemen, Pete Kaiser!
Sliding to a stop under Nome's burled arch, Pete Kaiser is bundled beyond recognition. He's suited up against the wind. He looks like an astronaut landing from space.
He's in there, I know he's in there.
Kaiser is another kind of traveler, traversing the subarctic wilderness quite alone for 10 days with his team of dogs. His eyebrows are heavy with icicles. He scoops his kids and family into his arms before showing the race marshal the bag of tools required for such a rigorous trip. It's the 38-year-old musher's 15th running of the Iditarod and a return to the roster after taking last year off.
Welcome back to Nome!
Earlier in the day, Kaiser appeared poised for a 10th place finish, But in the final 10 minutes of his 10-day race, Kaiser ran head-to-head with Canadian musher Michelle Phillips. Kaiser began to close the gap along the final 2 miles of Bering Sea Ice Trail before ultimately pulling ahead of Phillips, securing 9th place. Not long after Kaiser, Michelle runs into the chute, and her dogs and Kaiser's dogs share a brief bark of surprise, or maybe athlete's relief, like, nice game, nice game. The 9th place victory is another notch in Kaiser's history of consistently ranking within the top 10 finishers in the field. 7 years ago, Kaiser pulled even farther ahead, taking first place as the Iditarod champion. This year's title went to musher Jesse Holmes, who won his 2nd consecutive race late on March 17th. It was Kaiser's first Iditarod run since becoming a title holder champion of his hometown race, the Kuskokwim 300. Kaiser said out there, it was one of the best Iditarod trails he's seen, especially from the top of Rainy Pass through the finish. Kaiser's starting team of 16 dogs was a blend of Iditarod veterans and younger athletes.
It's a fun group of dogs. The young ones are just, you know, super energetic and eager and hard-pulling, and the old ones were fun to watch. They just knew what they were doing.
Along the trail, several dogs on Kaiser's team became sick. Kaiser began dropping dogs early in the race and appeared to supplement by taking extra rest at or between checkpoints to allow his reduced team to recoup.
Just didn't come together the way we'd hoped, with a little bit of bad luck and whatnot, but that's Iditarod, really.
He says after managing the sick dogs, he realized positioning was something he'd let go of. But working the team up the coast, Kaiser says it felt like they could maybe sneak their way into the top 10 again. Crossing the finish line, his 8-dog team appeared perky and were soon rewarded for their 1,000-mile triumph as Kaiser dispersed chunks of meat. Since the speed of life has picked up, Kaiser, who used to train all season with the race in mind, says the Iditarod has become a year-by-year decision.
It's hard to explain, really. I think it's one of those things that when you're not doing it, you think of all the really fun parts of it. And then when you're doing it, you're just busy with all the really hard parts of it.
He says, though, that back on the trail, it's the people, the volunteers and folks at checkpoints he's gotten to know over the years, who he'll remember fondly. That and the thing itself, says Kaiser, being out on the trail, traveling by dog team across Alaska, make for something pretty remarkable. At the finish line in Nome, I'm Samantha Watson.
If you've been to a Petersburg High School boys basketball game sometime in the last 30 years, there's a good chance you've seen head coach Rick Brock standing on the sidelines. Brock has been an integral part of Petersburg basketball, and as KFSK's Taylor Heckert reports, he recently received an award from the National High School Basketball Coaches Association, recognizing his commitment to the sport and student athletes.
At the end of Petersburg's homecoming games last month, friends and family waited on the sidelines to recognize the hard work of the high school seniors in basketball, cheer, and pep band. But there was also someone else whose hard work was being recognized that evening. Athletics director Jamie Cabral made the announcement.
And also another recognition we'd like to recognize as part of the Alaska Association of Basketball Coaches. This person just received the John R. Wooden Legacy Award. This prestigious honor recognizes educators and coaches who have achieved excellence on the court, in the classroom, and throughout their communities, truly reflecting the character, leadership, and lasting impact of Coach John R. Wooden. So, along with the Alaska Association of Basketball Coaches, please recognize Coach Rick Brock, who just received that award for 2026.
Rick Brock has been coaching for about 38 years, and 36 of those have been in Petersburg. That's long enough that Brock has coached generations of basketball players. Here's Noah Powick, a senior on the varsity team.
He coached my dad even, so he's been doing it for years, and he knows how to coach, and he knows what he's doing. And
Noah says with Brock as his coach, he saw some big wins during his high school basketball career.
he coaches for success. Like, I've been part of a team that's won a state championship my sophomore year, and Coach Brock was head of the helm.
But Cabral says being a great coach also involves a lot of work off the basketball court. That means early mornings, late nights, and consistently showing up for Petersburg's youth.
You know, coaching is not just your season from December 3rd from first practice to the last game of the season. It's, you know, helping the kids on the off season, doing fundraising, supporting them at their other sports.
Cabral says Brock puts in long hours behind the scenes to make Petersburg student athletes successful. Plus, he says that Brock has played a large role in guiding Petersburg's teenage boys into becoming respectful, well-rounded young men.
Everybody kind of knows, kind of associates, you know, Rick Brock and Petersburg basketball, even though he did graduate from Wrangell. But he is, he's respected across the state, just a knowledge piece of basketball, the game itself, and understanding concepts.
If you ask Brock about his award, he says it's a reflection of the community around him. He says he wouldn't be able to do this without the support of his family, the school, and especially the players.
It's not me. It's all the guys that have played, all the hours and time that they put in, their families supporting and fundraising and letting their kids try. You know, it's the whole thing, going to summer camp and then the administration and the school, you know, just giving everything. And
he says the team wouldn't be successful without the hard work of the other winter activities during the basketball season.
A very wise coach once told me, to have a good basketball program, you have to have a quality pep band and quality cheerleaders. And it has to be the atmosphere of the gym, and the community wants to come and experience that. And it makes it special for the kids.
Brock says he feels very blessed and humbled to receive the recognition. In Petersburg, I'm Taylor Hackert.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Ashlyn O'Hara in Kenai, Alona Niden in Koktovik, Michaela Finnerty and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Davis Hovey in Kodiak, Samantha Watson in Nome, and Taylor Hackert in Petersburg. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us, news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde, Kirsten Dobroth is our producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.